budget is based on fantasy, and it does not set us up for success either in the next few years or across generations.
The State House passes an operating budget, but not without some skepticism. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for April 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaskans and Canadians along the Yukon River continue working to revive dwindling king salmon runs.
If we're not changing and we're not trying to make things better for them, like that rebuilding plan, we are likely looking at the extinction of our Chinook.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Alaska House of Representatives passed its $6 billion operating budget today. That's the spending plan for day-to-day government operations beginning next June. There's a lot to work through in the budget, though, so here to tell us more is Alaska Public Media's Capitol reporter Eric Stone. Hi, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
So what is in this budget?
So for that, let's first hear from Representative Delina Johnson. She's a Palmer Republican and the House's operating budget chair.
This budget prioritizes public safety, education, a strong permanent fund dividend, essential services to Alaskans, and provides support to Alaska's most vulnerable populations.
Some of the highlights are $175 million in one-time funding for public schools, which is equivalent to a $680 per student increase, and another $44 million for school bond debt reimbursement. There are 10 new village public safety officers, more attorneys in the Department of Law, and $90 million in community assistance, among many other things. There are lots of priorities from the mostly Democratic and independent minority in there, too. A couple of note, there's an amendment from Ketchikan Independent Representative Dan Ortez, adding $5 million each to statewide seafood and tourism marketing programs, and another from Juneau Democrat Andy Story adds about $9 million to help with reading programs for young students. Johnson says nobody's totally satisfied, and that's what makes it a good compromise.
Each person here gave a little, and each person got a little. That's what this budget represents, Madam Speaker.
And one of those compromises is the permanent fund dividend.
Yeah, always a topic of interest. So what's the PFD looking like?
So at this point, the House is sticking with about $2,300. That's the amount set by the Finance Committee. There were a few attempts to change that on the floor, but none of them wound up sticking. Johnson says the budget as written has a surplus of nearly $80 million, and Representative Jamie Allard, an Eagle River Republican, says it's an attempt to pay the biggest possible dividend without jeopardizing future payouts.
No, it's not a full PFD, but I want the community and the state constituents to recognize that it is the third largest. We're doing the best that we can. And in order to make that PFD and the dividend for the long duration of the time, we have to be very careful and wise to what we're doing.
But not everybody agrees that the state can afford it. Members of the House minority, mostly Democrats and independents, they say the budget's artificially low and doesn't account for lots of stuff that will eventually need to be rolled into the budget, like more than $500 million in capital projects that the House and Senate have agreed to spend. Representative Cliff Groh, an Anchorage Democrat, put it this way.
This budget is based on fantasy, and it does not set us up for success either in the next few years or across generations.
He says new revenues could help with that, and minority members also pointed to some other things that they saw as missing pieces.
Oh, yeah? What sort of things?
One of the missing pieces we've heard a lot about is the rising cost of energy. Here's Representative Maxine Dybert, a Democrat from Fairbanks.
I can't in good conscience send a budget over to the other body without addressing energy.
One specific item is funding for electrical transmission line upgrades that could make energy more affordable, especially in the interior. The state got a giant federal grant for that, and it requires more than $200 million in matching state funds over several years. But members of the Republican-led majority say there's another place for that. Here's Representative Will Stapp. He's a Republican from Fairbanks.
Energy is certainly the number one problem facing the interior. It is, however, a problem that can best be solved through the budget and the capital budget, Madam Speaker, not the operating budget.
And the Senate rolled out its draft of the capital budget today. They'll work through amendments in the coming days and pass it over to the House.
All right, Eric, so where do things go from here?
Well, pretty soon the Senate will take its crack at the operating budget, and they are pretty skeptical that the budget is in fact balanced. The Senate's operating budget chair, Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, sounded a lot like what we've heard from the Democrats and independents in the House. He's been beating this drum all session, asking folks to look at what's not in the budget, and he says with capital projects, bills that have passed, and everything else, it's not balanced.
So by the time you add that all in, they're underwater somewhere around $276 million. So that's a lot of gaposis to deal with in the conference committee, and we have to get the ends to meet.
And that was before amendments added a little under $20 million to the budget. Stedman has been pretty consistent that the dividend should be a quarter of the state's annual draw from the permanent fund, and this year that would come out to about $1,600 a person. For now, though, we are on track to avoid a government shutdown. This week was the agreed-upon deadline for the operating budget to pass, and it did, but it remains to be seen whether it'll stay on track.
Okay, that was Alaska Public Media's Capitol reporter Eric Stone. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The Yukon River Panel, a joint Alaska-Canada salmon advisory organization, held a multi-day preseason meeting this week in Anchorage. Panel members heard presentations and public comments on a range of salmon issues, including a recent Alaska-Canada agreement to close Chinook fishing for 7 years. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Wednesday's Yukon River panel agenda included presentations by biologists on 2024 salmon run forecasts. Dina Jallin with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game said another weak return of Yukon River Chinook is anticipated.
We have a forecast of 45,000 to 68,000 fish with a median value of 56,000 fish. And as a reminder, the 2023 drainage-wide run size for Chinook salmon was 58,000 fish, and no escapement goals were met in Alaska or Canada. So we're anticipating a very low run, similar to last year or smaller.
About 40% of Yukon River Chinook are Canadian origin fish, and Jallin said the outlook for those stocks is similarly bleak.
19,000 to 28,000 fish with a median value of 23,000 fish, and that's below the border passage objective of 71,000 fish. And the projected border passage could be as low as 9 to 19,000 fish.
About 15,000 Chinook crossed the border last year. An agreement signed by Alaska and Canadian fishery managers last month halts the harvest of Chinook on the main stem of the Yukon as well as Canadian tributaries for 7 years in an attempt to rebuild border passage to the 71,000 fish objective. Panel member Elizabeth McDonald of Whitehorse spoke in support of the agreement, which includes development of measures to grow back the Chinook run, which has been on a downward trajectory for 3 decades.
If we're not changing and we're not trying to make things better for them, like that rebuilding plan, we are likely looking at the extinction of our Chinook.
During public testimony, Norma Cassie of Whitehorse said the Alaska-Canada Chinook Harvest Moratorium Agreement has been many years in the making.
This is an important step forward, I think. Our ancient ways have always have to have a place. And our ways is to leave a place alone if the animals are declining.
Cassie, who directs an Indigenous research organization, talked about a new program that will educate a group of young people from Canada and Alaska about traditional knowledge as well as Western science and politics to better understand salmon and what threatens them.
We'll learn about climatic changes and what has happened to our spawning grounds and in the oceans. They will look at the hydro dams, mining industry, sports fishing, as well as large-scale commercial trawling.
Alaska side upper river fisher Carrie Stevens underscored that local people stopped harvesting Chinook years ago and said broader measures are needed.
We are already standing down. The numbers are not changing. And it is the nation state's attempt to not address further issues. The trawling, Area M.
The Yukon River panel wrapped up its preseason meeting Thursday. It plans to reconvene in the fall to work on development of the Chinook rebuilding plan required by the Alaska-Canada agreement. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau's fascination with fast food doesn't make the businesses any more lucrative.
It is hands down one of the most challenging locations in the United States to operate a business.
That's ahead. Stay with us. After months of waiting, the Federal Emergency Management Agency set up a disaster recovery center in Wrangell to help individuals affected by November's deadly landslide. Several tables are set up for different types of assistance inside the community's Nolan Center. Besides FEMA, there's the National Preparedness Division and the Small Business Administration. Nika Hereford is FEMA's Individual Assistance Branch Director. She says the Disaster Recovery Center can help Wrangell residents sign up for different types of assistance available to them, whether it's for a disaster-caused loss they experienced or something else that could help. She says they have partnered with Wrangell's tribal government, Wrangell Cooperative Association.
It's not all about FEMA assistance or assistance from the Small Business Administration. We work with a lot of different partners that have programs and other resources that may be helpful, not only for this incident, but for the future.
The partners also include the Internal Revenue Service for tax help and the Department of Housing and Urban Development for mortgage and foreclosure issues. The USDA Rural Development Agency also has loans and grants that may be available for people who were affected. Hereford says that people should come in if their homes were affected in any way. Even if the slide didn't make them uninhabitable, they could receive repair funds. For example, if the storms impacted their septic systems or wells or a vehicle was lost, FEMA could also help.
If people lost work, they were affected, if they're self-employed and they wouldn't otherwise qualify for regular unemployment assistance, that would be another area where they would want to talk with us about applying for disaster unemployment assistance.
FEMA can also help replace subsistence foods and firewood. Hereford says FEMA and Wrangell's tribe are talking about a possible crisis counseling grant to help with healing in the community and disaster legal services. Meanwhile, the city and borough of Wrangell is lending Ketchikan an ambulance after a fire destroyed some of that town's emergency equipment. The fire burned early Tuesday morning inside one of the Ketchikan area fire stations, South Tongass Fire Department. No one was injured. Wrangell's borough manager Mason Villarma says he was notified by the Wrangell Volunteer Fire Department Captain Jordan Bunis that Ketchikan needed help.
Jordan Bunis came into my office and said, hey, we need to send our ambulance down. And so we got the ambulance on the barge, and now they have an ambulance that they can use.
Wrangell has three ambulances in total. Villarma says that the city does have ample coverage and solutions in case an emergency happens while one of the ambulances is gone.
I think that's a great testament to our volunteer fire department and kind of giving back to some communities that really helped us during the landslide. So just a note on that, and thanking the volunteer fire department for being aware of surrounding community events and thinking of Ketchikan during a difficult time.
Fire Chief Tim Bunis says he's not sure how long the South Tongass Fire Department will need the ambulance. He says that depends on the structural damage to the back of their ambulance that was in the fire. According to the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, the fire was started by a piece of equipment. The State Fire Marshal's Office is investigating. An Alaska Superior Court judge sentenced a Washington man Tuesday to 99 years in prison for murdering Eric Garcia, a prominent Ketchikan surgeon. Judge Michael Wolverton handed down the maximum possible sentence to 38-year-old Jordan Joplin for the murder, saying it was one of the most brazen and craven acts he's seen in his 40 years on the bench. KRBD's Jack Darrell was in the courtroom for the emotional day-long sentencing hearing and has this report.
The front row of the courtroom was packed with Eric Garcia's family and friends. They wore shiny maroon ribbons pinned to their chests. Eric's brother, Saul Garcia, was the first to take the stand. He described Eric as a loving brother and skillful surgeon. He remembered being approached at a Mexican restaurant in town by a group of Spanish-speaking workers after Eric's death. They said his brother had provided them medicine when they couldn't afford it.
They recounted how comfortable they felt to have access to a Spanish-speaking medical professional that related to their culture. Many worried about the future of their medical care as they didn't feel comfortable speaking English.
Garcia was a prominent surgeon in Southeast Alaska. He lived in Ketchikan, but performed surgeries for smaller communities in the region. Last year, Joplin was found guilty of murdering the surgeon. During the trial, prosecutors said that the two men were in a romantic relationship in the years leading up to Garcia's murder. Prosecutors said that in 2017, Joplin administered a fatal dose of morphine and other drugs to Garcia and loaded three large shipping containers with nearly 2 tons of Garcia's expensive personal belongings to send back to the lower 48. Saul Garcia said that in the 6 years since his brother's death, the family has been swimming through a disorienting fog of grief.
I felt guilty by not knowing Eric had been suffering from domestic abuse. How did I not know that? How did I not pick up on that? Why didn't I call him more frequently or spend more time with him?
Eric Garcia's sister wasn't present in the courtroom, but delivered a statement through District Attorney Mark Clark. She described their upbringing in a small town in Puerto Rico and Garcia's life in Ketchikan. The statement outlined a time in her brother's life, the time when Joplin entered it.
Eric didn't have a lot of time for himself. He was working more hours than he could physically deal with. At this point in his life, he was very lonely, working many night shifts.
She and Saul said that their brother was a romantic partner, friend, and protector to Joplin. During the trial, the prosecution presented evidence that Garcia had paid for Joplin's child support, mortgage, and legal fees, as well as jointly leased a car to help Joplin build credit. The only person who took the stand to support a lower sentence for Jordan Joplin was Blake Joplin, the defendant's half-brother. He painted a different picture of Jordan. Blake said he met Jordan 13 years ago when the pair were connected on Facebook. He said they have the same father, but they weren't raised together. They eventually connected in person, and Blake said that the brother that he met wasn't someone capable of murder.
Jordan is a loving, charismatic, just generally happy individual. Very positive.
Joplin said he and his half-brother had talked regularly for 13 years. Jordan Joplin was also given the opportunity to testify for himself, which he did through his attorney.
And so Jordan asked me to note that he acknowledges Dr. Garcia's death, the effect it had on the family and Dr. Garcia's friends and the community of Ketchikan, and that he maintains his innocence of the crime.
Prosecuting attorney Aaron McCarthy asked for the greatest sentence possible, though.
The domestic, intimate relationship Mr. Joplin fabricated between himself and Dr. Garcia is not only a factor to consider, but it is as much the murder weapon as the poison Mr. Joplin ultimately used to kill the man who loved him. Perhaps the most horrific part of this crime is how Dr. Garcia wholly gave his heart to Mr. Joplin, while for Mr. Joplin, Dr. Garcia was disposable.
She said the amount of malice and forethought in this crime was chilling. Judge Wolverton agreed. He paused for a long time before delivering his statements. He also disagreed with the defense's position that the community impact shouldn't be factored into this case.
And the community condemnation, both from this courtroom today, throughout the community of Ketchikan, and all the way up to Anchorage and throughout Alaska, calls for imposition of a significant sentence.
Then he addressed Joplin directly, saying that his actions were inexplicable. You had access to Dr. Garcia's wealth, he said. He wasn't withholding. The judge also gave him 2 years for the theft to be served concurrently. As Joplin was fingerprinted and led out of the courtroom, Garcia's family and friends cried and exchanged hugs with prosecuting attorneys. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
A bill that would allow disabled veterans a free lifetime pass to Alaska state parks and campsites is moving through the legislature. Nikiski Republican Senator Jesse Bjorkman pre-filed the bill back in January, and it's been heard in the Senate Resources Committee 3 times over the past 2 months. Here's Bjorkman introducing the bill at a March hearing.
I would like for our veterans who have given so many years and many times their blood in service of our country to have permanent access to our state parks, as well as campgrounds and parking.
In its final resources hearing Monday, the committee considered 2 amendments to the bill. The first made some minor language changes, and the committee adopted it. The second would allow a pass holder to have more than one physical pass if they had additional vehicles, like an RV. But after discussing concerns about the number of stickers that would be issued, committee co-chair Senator Kathy Geisel suggested a solution.
Why can't this be like a handicap hang-down device on the rearview mirror that is movable from vehicle to vehicle? The veteran gets one, and that makes it quite portable.
The amendment was withdrawn, and the Resources Committee voted to move the bill on to Senate Finance. It will now need to go through the Finance Committee, Senate, and House. The law would go into effect on January 1st of 2025. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has received a $20 million National Science Foundation grant to research climate change effects on marine species in the Gulf of Alaska and the communities that depend on them. NSF Director Seth Raman Panchanathan announced the Research Infrastructure Improvement Award at UAF yesterday, saying it aims to help answer key climate questions.
How do you mitigate? How do you adapt? How do you build resilient futures through science and technology?
According to an NSF release, UAF scientists will work with counterparts at UAA and UAS to conduct community-engaged research. Panchanathan emphasized the grant's focus on local knowledge and diversity.
In terms of engaging with the community, which is the most important thing, because it's important to have everybody involved and the community-based solutions.
The new program called Interface for Change is the sixth five-year NSF-funded project under the university's established program to stimulate competitive research, or EBSCOR. Fast food restaurants have ebbed and flowed in and out of Alaska for decades, and in the capital city, the list of failed fast food chains is much longer than success stories. But why is it so hard to run a profitable chain in Alaska? KTOO's Clarice Larson went in search of an answer in Juneau.
Beyond Subway, McDonald's, and three pizza chains, Domino's, Papa John's, and Papa Murphy's, you won't find any other fast food options in Alaska's capital city. Some residents, like Ked Judson, who was grabbing a Subway sandwich during a recent lunch hour, wish they had more options.
Well, you know, Taco Bell, Burger King, or Arby's, or, you know, we see the commercials, but we're always stuck with just the one McDonald's, and there used to be other stuff. So I think there's still room for more.
He's right, partly. Juneau once had popular chains like Taco Bell, Burger King, and Wendy's, and some even had multiple locations. But they came and went. Any day of the week, you can pull up to McDonald's in Juneau and grab a Big Mac and fries. It's right by the McNugget intersection.
Hello, order when you're ready.
At one time, there were two McDonald's in Juneau. The first, which still exists today, opened in 1982 near the airport. In the early years, corporate officials said it sold more hamburgers and fries in its first week than any other store in the company's history. 4 years later, a second McDonald's opened downtown. That one closed in 2010. There's no Taco Bell in Juneau today, but at one time there were two. Wendy's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Time, Burger King, and Baskin Robbins. They all came and went by the mid-90s. Burger King even had a food truck, but that was shut down by the mid-90s too.
It's interesting when you look historically at Juneau. I mean, McDonald's is sort of the sole success story, right?
That's Bruce Denton, who opened the two-story Senate building downtown in 1982 and still owns it today. Wendy's and Burger King had locations there in the 80s. Denton says the downtown area is tough for restaurants in general, but especially fast food, because you can't put in a drive-through and there's not enough foot traffic.
They clearly weren't getting enough traffic, you know, particularly in the winter. And you know, you think about the cruise ship passengers, they're one thing about the cruise is that they're royally fed, right? So there's not a lot of tourists that are scrambling in to eat.
One of the few fast food restaurants in Juneau that has passed the test of time is Subway. Its owner is Assemblymember Wade Bryson. He says owning any business in Juneau is tough, but trying to make money in fast food here is like walking a razor-thin wire.
What do you call a business without profit? You call it closed. It is hands down one of the most challenging locations in the United States to operate a business.
Bryson took over the two existing Subway restaurants in Juneau in 2004, one in the valley and one downtown. The downtown location burned down less than a year later. Now he just has one Subway in town. He says like many businesses in Juneau, fast food restaurants deal with three big issues: inflated prices, lack of housing, and a struggle to find workers. To make a profit, he says he typically needs to charge about 30% more than what a Subway sandwich would cost in the lower 48.
The cost of food is just escalating literally on a daily basis. And in Alaska, the housing crisis, which led to the employment crisis, which led to the wage crisis, which has now compounded the housing crisis, which is compounding the wage crisis. I mean, it's all just circling together.
None of this is new. Even back in 1995, former McDonald's owner and operator Mike White told the Juneau Empire that finding employees in Juneau was tough. Dale Martins, the former vice president of the Anchorage Taco Bell of Alaska, was quoted in a story saying that staffing in Juneau, quote, has always been a challenge. Bryson says the demand for fast food in Juneau hasn't gone away, but running a restaurant in Juneau, and in most parts of Alaska, often just doesn't pencil out.
I wish I had a dollar for every person that asked me to open up Taco Bell again here in town. I would have had enough money to do it.
So no, Bryson has no plans to open a Taco Bell in Juneau. He's just focused on making sure he can keep his one Subway restaurant profitable. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
Well, that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in that Taco Bell-less Juneau. Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Colette Zarnicki in Wrangell, Jack Darrell in Ketchikan, and Riley Board in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.